Comics and Culture Radar, a podcast that's on the lookout for what's good to read and watch.
If you don't know who Milton is, let's ask the Suicide Squad what they think.
Who's Milton?
What?
I don't remember any Milton.
Fuck! He has been with us the whole time!
Somebody named Milton has been with us the whole
time! Yes!
I don't think so. I think I would have noticed if a guy named Milton's been with us. It's not a very common name. I don't think I've ever even met Milton.
Hello and welcome to the program. Today we are talking to Wells Thompson and Dalton Shannon. Could you guys introduce yourselves for me? Wells, how about you go first?
My name is Wells Thompson. I feel like we covered that ground. I'm a comic book writer presently located in Nashville, Tennessee. I rescue cats and I eat vegetarian food most of the time.
And how about you, Dalton?
Hey, yeah, I'm Dalton. I'm a writer, cartoonist, and comic dude who likes making comics like Mechaton and all sorts of other goodies in Arkansas, soon to be Wisconsin.
That's cool. And yeah, we're here to talk about Mechaton today. But before we talk about Mechaton, I'm gonna steal some of your time for just my own personal entertainment needs and ask you guys, what's on your radar? Give us something in the entertainment world that you think is kind of cool, and maybe something that's kind of more on the obscure side. Wells, how about you go first? Do you have anything you can recommend to us from the world of movies, TV, or comics?
Just so much. It's a problem. Let's see. I think I have to, in good faith, shout out Grant Stoy, who's currently running a campaign for SideQuest number 4. SideQuest is a sort of D&D light comic, which, if you're like me, when you hear that, you're like, okay, I'm immediately checked out and I don't want anything to do with this. But I was surprised by how, like, smart and moving and well done it is. And in light of several of these kind of, you know, D&D structured comics coming out, there's one that just came out, either Vault or Scout, I don't remember. But put all of them aside, SideQuest is the only one that you need. It's a really cool, like, On one level, it's like kind of challenging the reader itself for even engaging in escapist fiction at all. Like how we deal with escapist entertainment and how we make it a substitute for real life. And on the other level, it is just a really entertaining comic with lots of really engaging characters, which at the end of the day is all I really care about in my comics. So that's where I'd start.
Very cool. How about you, Dalton? Let me put you on the spot. Have you got anything that you can recommend for us?
Well, I usually go back to, because the guy still does not have the mainstream recognition that he deserves. But Michel Fife had a nice run in like 2018 where he got on Bloodstrike and G.I. Joe. Like that dude was firing on all cylinders. He even got Copra published through Image. But this dude is a cartoonist who is writing, penciling, inking, coloring, hand lettering, and self-publishing every single book he puts out. He's been publishing Copra, his Suicide Squad pastiche, since like 2012, and issue 41 just came into my mailbox like a month or two ago. The guy is doing things with comics that I have never seen before. Layouts and lettering techniques, printing techniques, that if you haven't checked out his stuff, the easiest way is to just grab all the Copra trades through Image Comics, and then immediately go to his Patreon or his Etsy store and sign up for a Copra subscription. And then every month you can get the best damn action comic on the shelf mailed directly to your door. And maybe we can get Fife on a monthly book that everyone is reading.
Now, you said it was kind of like a Suicide Squad. I've read the first trade, and maybe my memory is fading, but is it kind of a mashup of Suicide Squad and G.I. Joe? Or I thought there was like a G.I. Joe element as well.
I mean, insofar as it's a government task force. So it's very much the government is sending this team of imperfect people to do jobs they want off the record. And it continuously gets bogged down into like geopolitics and other dimensional fourth world chaos that almost breaks the page with how awesome it is.
That is cool. As for myself, I recently found something super obscure, or at least it's obscure to me. I was shopping for Christmas gifts, and I was in a bookstore that also does home video, and I saw this title among the more like elite Criterion DVDs on a display, but it's a Yakuza film from the early 1980s called Sailor Suit and Machine Gun. Have either of you guys ever heard of this thing?
No, but you've already sold me.
Okay.
Yeah, no, title alone, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm on board.
This is one of those things where, yeah, you look at the title and you hope that that's what it delivers, and that is exactly what it delivers. It's a story about a Japanese teenage girl in the standard school uniform outfit becomes the chairman of a Yakuza gang. And one of the more endearing aspects of this film is, I mean, it's got like a cult film quality to it throughout, and it's got over the top violence and just crazy silliness, but it also kind of takes its silly premise kind of seriously and really wonders like, okay, what would it be like if some teenage schoolgirl took over a Yakuza clan? And so let's explore that for 2 hours. So it wasn't just, you know, pure exploitative action scenes throughout. And it was just a whole lot of fun. And I think it just recently got remastered or something and put out by Arrow Video. But you don't have to buy the thing. You can just, the new version is available for streaming or rental streaming at a number of outlets. I can't remember which one I found it from, but it should be really easy to find. So before we got started recording, Wells teased that he could come here with well more than just one recommendation. So why don't you hit us with another one?
Jesus. All right. I've been really enamored with this book, And We Walked for Miles, by Ali Burke and Tara Hamilton. They're a couple of comic book collaborators out of, I think, Knoxville, Tennessee. Which I live very close to there, so I was immediately interested. And it's this really interesting, like, compilation of comics that they've done over the last something like 10 years. And it is, like, soul-crushingly sincere, is the way I would describe it. Like, on the one hand, you know, you could pick apart and be like, well, the art is kind of scraggly and not perfect, and the lettering, you know, definitely needs some work. But underneath kind of all of that, you have this very, like, tragically personal kind of story being told. One of my favorite moments is early on in the book, there are these series of vignettes that are just labeled anxieties. and it's like as between 2 and 6 panels each of just things like the first time she experienced like death and learned what, you know, death was and what fear of death was. And after a couple of pages of this, there's one where like she's describing how she lost her grandma, and halfway through she stops drawing and just says, "I don't want to do this anymore. I'm sorry. This is too much." The panels are like there for the rest of the page. They're just empty, and the captions are there so you can read them, but like it remains empty for the rest of the page, and it's just like this really intensely personal moment that you feel like you just have been led in on without meaning to.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it's really cool. They run their own like press called Fine OK Press. That's just OK, the letters. And you can buy the book directly from them. So I definitely recommend doing that. It's a really, really cool experience.
And Dalton, do you have a second offering for us?
Well, in a complete 180, can we talk about how cool the Ultraman Trigger toys are?
Hell yeah.
I'm all in favor of this, but I'm completely ignorant, so school me on the on these toys.
Okay, well, mostly I want to talk about Ultraman Trigger and how much I love Ultraman, as you can probably tell from Mechaton itself and all the Toku influence. But big man grows big to punch monsters in the face is awesome, and the gimmick of Ultraman is he always has a transformation device. Sometimes it's like a gyro, sometimes it's a capsule of some kind, but Ultraman Trigger, appropriately enough, is a gun, which is odd to me considering Japan and their relationship with firearms, in that they don't have one necessarily. And so like the main character works with this military outfit, as is standard for Ultraman. And he's got this gun called a Spark Lance that he pulls out of the holster, and he can pull the hinge back on the top. So the top of the gun pulls back and reveals like a diamond in the center, and it becomes like this little Sailor Moon looking lance. And he pulls the trigger and transforms into Ultraman. And he has all these different form types that look like ammo cartridges that he puts into the bottom of it and pulls the trigger and turns into. And then he's got like a sword that he puts the cartridges in. And all of these toys look so cool. And I know this show is just a toy commercial, but dang it, I'm already sucked in and I want to buy it. And they just make so many cool noises. The sword turns into a bow that shoots energy light. Like it's, I can't get over just how cool the toys are.
Now the show itself, is this a contemporary show or something classic?
It's airing right now, which is something that Tsuburaya Productions, the guys who make Ultraman, they've only just recently started doing. Tokusatsu is notoriously hard to watch over here in the West because the companies that make them don't localize them. Because they don't think there's a market here. But since like 2020, Tsuburaya has been making a hard push to try and get Ultraman popular over here. So they have started simultaneously casting the premieres of Ultraman on their YouTube channel with English subtitles. So you can watch Ultraman Trigger every week on their YouTube channel as it premieres. And I have seen better Ultraman shows. Trigger's kind of lame, but the gimmick is so cool, and the theme song rips. Like no matter what, your day's automatically better because the Trigger theme song is one of the greatest theme songs I've ever heard in my life.
Oh well, I'm gonna have to immediately check that part out.
My wife thinks Tokusatsu is one of the stupidest things on earth, and she's right. But every time I listen, I'm watching it and the theme song comes on, she starts pumping her fist and singing along.
And you can definitely get people hooked on a theme song, for sure. That's how my wife got me on Madoka Magica.
Oh my god. Yeah, and by sing along, I mean definitely mumble the Japanese parts until you hear a word you recognize, and then you belt it out.
So I will close out the recommendation portion here with something that's maybe borderline on the obscurity scorecard, but it's a very recent film release, and it's called Come On, Come On, by the director Mike Mills, who I think is a ridiculously underrated filmmaker. His most recent film, 20th Century Women, was just phenomenal, in my opinion. And this one is a black and white film starring Joaquin Phoenix. And Joaquin Phoenix plays a sort of audio journalist, not really a podcaster, but someone more in the vein of like a New York Times podcast or a Ira Glass network of personalities kind of show. And it's about a relationship with him and a young child and his family who are brought together in unique circumstances while he's in the middle of doing this lengthy series of interviews with other children about the state of the world. And it's got gorgeous photography and just got a real sense of, you know, ennui and uncertainty about the age that we're living in. So I highly recommend it, even though I made it sound kind of dour. It's definitely worth checking out. So let's segue into why we're here today to talk about Mechaton. And before we get into the specifics of Mechaton, why don't you give us a little bit of background? Wells and Dalton, like how do you guys even know each other?
A wizard cursed me to know my shame in human form, and thus Dalton was born.
I was going to say farmersonly.com.
Dalton and I met in college. We went to the University of Central Arkansas together, at least for Dalton for the last 2 years of his college career. I was there the whole time. But I actually met his wife first. I don't remember where. I think it was like a gen ed class, like a psychology 101 or something like that. But we would like go and have breakfast early in the morning because we had early classes and complain and stuff. And she introduced us, and you know, I'm not gonna say that we were like fast friends or anything like that, but we had a good rapport right away. And then we started actually, you know, showing up in each other's writing classes, and we recognized, I think mutually, but really quickly, that we were among, if not the best, we were definitely top three in the class. So we started hanging out
doing
projects together. Like, I mean, I don't mean any disrespect to anyone else that was in that class, but if you've ever been in a writing seminar, you know who the good ones are, like, right away. And for us, it was, like, consistently us two, and then this girl, Taylor Brady, who is one of the most brilliant poets I've ever met in my life.
Yeah,
she actually
way better.
She got a full ride to University of Iowa. She's, like, a poet laureate. It's ridiculous.
Ugh. Wow.
I'm disgusted with her talent.
I know, it's so gross. But, yeah, no, we did a writing exercise where we just pulled from a list of prompts, and Dalton, in about 40 minutes, had written an incredibly long piece about how this character was going on a blind date. He had set up through Tinder, and he had lied on his profile.
Mingle.
Whatever. And he had sort of lied on his profile, but he didn't think it was that big a deal. And but he's getting weird vibes off the date, and it's slowly revealed that his date is a velociraptor in a blonde wig. And the entire class is like cracking up the entire time because his like Dalton style is just naturally very bantery and funny. And I just remember thinking, yeah, I got to keep this guy around. This is too good.
And so, other than mutual admiration and respect in college, what led you guys to step up to become collaborators? And then specifically, why comics?
I dragged Wells kicking and screaming, honestly.
Yeah, it's about right. Yeah, we had sort of tried very hard to do several different collaborations for different things. You know, we had a podcasting phase, and that sort of petered out. We tried to get like multiple of our friends from college together to like do a multimedia website kind of thing, and that was extremely, as you can imagine, probably extremely difficult to coordinate and didn't work out at all. But, you know, me and Dalton were producing pretty consistent content, so we just kept, you know, looking at each other's stuff. And I think the tipping point was Dalton had been working on this this comic for a really long time, but he was kind of stuck on it and couldn't figure out what to do with it or how to end it. And after a little while, I was like, I think something there's something here. Do you want me to just kind of grab it and see what I can do with it? And he was just like, go for it. And then like a month later, I came back with I had turned it into like a film script because that's how what I knew how to write. I didn't really understand like what comic writing was then. And it was like clumsy, and it definitely needed to be like hammered out, but it was a thing, like it was finished. And kind of the shape of what it was is, still what like it is now what it is today, even though it only exists as a script right now. It's definitely a future project we're going to be working on, but that sort of experience of working together, I think, let us know that, oh, this is a good time, and we bounce off of each other really well. And then Dalton was doing these like 8-page scripts, almost as a writing exercise. And I was like, you know what, why don't we just draw these and try and sell them and see what we can do.
So tell us a little bit about the division of labor in your collaboration. Do you guys separate into different areas of focus? Is one of you better than the other in one capacity and vice versa? Or do you have the same strengths and weaknesses? How does this all work for you guys?
So we both share a keyboard. I write one line, and then Wells writes one line. And
I was going to say, your right hand. You're right hand, I'm left hand.
Yeah. No. It's, I think we not have very that complicated, yet still more complicated.
Is somehow. We have very kind of complementary styles, I think.
Yeah, for
like
sure.
Like on the writing front, it's very much Dalton came up with a metaphor that I really like is I keep the cart on the track and then Dalton keeps it moving. Just, you know, the things that I'm kind of naturally good with, plotting, character work and like theming and things like that. Dalton is much more interested in doing, you know, banter and set pieces and, you know, stuff that's going to make the action pop and the page turn. And so
momentum.
Yeah. Momentum. So yeah, it's a process of, I make a draft and then I hand it to him and then he makes a draft and we just hand it back and forth until we have something cool.
And speaking of something cool, you do have something cool. And
thank you.
You are about to launch or by the time this comes out, it will probably be the day of the launch for the first and second issue of your series, which I think I mispronounced earlier. It's Mechaton, right?
Mechaton.
Mechaton. Okay. I did say it right though. All right.
Yeah.
So, why don't you guys give us the pitch, for the series in general?
Ooh, Wells has been practicing this.
Oh Christ. All right. So Mechaton is about an alien glove that crash lands on Earth, and is picked up by a couple of idiots. And they quickly discover that anything they punch with the glove on turns into a mech and is reconstituted out of whatever they punch. So that could, like, the first issue is a hot dog stand. They punch, it's reconstituted into this mech, and then they have to use it to fight what are essentially kaiju. Giant mutated bugs that coincidentally, or maybe not so much, have started showing up around the same time as the glove crash landing to Earth.
Very cool. And one of the things that you may have emphasized Dalton's contribution on, but I'm sure you both had a angle here, but as a reader of the first issue, I felt that you had a lot of good humor and really good banter among your main characters there. And that's one of the delightful strengths of the book. So I want to compliment you guys on that.
Thank you.
Do you guys just riff jokes off of each other, or do you script it and share?
Well, a lot of the dialogue that I tend to write is me having a fictional conversation with my friends, and like I'm just considering the back and forth, and then I'll put a bunch of one-liners and stuff like that in there. And then Wells will come in and be like, okay, there's 100 speech bubbles on this page, Dalton. Maybe we should cut some of this.
And it's more out of like fear for our safety, because I know when we present it to the letterer, they're going to go, what the hell is this?
And he's completely right. And so Wells helps to trim that back, and he throws in a few, like Wells has come up with a lot of like one-liners and dialogue that flows together. Sometimes when he comes in, it saves the scene, because I just end on a dud sometimes. And the dialogue is just, I don't know, that's one of the things that just comes naturally, that it's, flows.
Yeah, it's very natural, and at the same time is probably the thing we work on the most, just by virtue of, like, we're working on it as we're doing everything else. So
right. It's one of the last things we work on before we send the script off. Yeah.
So yeah, we sometimes an entire scene starts with dialogue that we know we want, and no matter how it starts, it's like once we get to a point, we panel lock it, we know what the action looks like, but we're still tweaking the dialogue up until sometimes the 11th hour.
Yeah, and it can just be something as simple as the order the words are in, whether we want it to have like a comma or if we want to have a vowel where a consonant should, like it's such minute detail that it can be a little headache inducing.
Every now and then we have to take a step back and be like, is this important? Yeah. Are we just making
like,
it?
Like, guys, we're just talking about hot dogs here. What's the problem?
I think my favorite line that I added at like the 11th hour was, I'm not going back to space jail, Leah. Yeah,
I loved that. Yeah. That was a good one. But in addition to, somewhat in contrast to the way that this is probably coming off to some listeners at the moment is, we've been emphasizing the humor and the sort of outlandish aspect of the premise. You know, you punch something, you turn into a mech. However, one other core strength of this book is that it is grounded in a very well constructed sibling relationship that feels authentic. And it just brings the book another dimension to it. And I wondered if you guys could talk about that. Was that something you designed and planned, or did it grow organically? Or is that the sort of thing you always do in your writing?
Yeah, Mechaton's always been about family, and the sibling relationship has been there since the very first draft. It didn't quite look like this, but it's always been about two siblings, and thankfully we're both siblings, so we're able to pull a lot of our own experiences into that relationship.
Funny enough, neither of us have sisters, though, which is
yeah.
Weird. No,
go ahead.
I was just like, we're both, I'm the youngest, he's the oldest, so we have kind of that dynamic to go off of. We also just have our own friendship, which I'm not going to say is exactly like a sibling relationship, but we rib on each other in the same way that siblings do. So
like friends do.
The way Leah and Derek talk to each other is very often the way we talk to each other. It also presented, I tend to get stuck in my own writing with like using as few characters as possible. So some ways I try and do that is like, okay, well, let's split up these roles. Like, if we have one guy in the mech who's also calling all the shots, not only is that incredibly linear and like not, you know, you're not interacting with anything really. You just kind of have a guy talking to himself. It's also going to get boring really quickly because you only really have one guy talking to himself. So as soon as you split that up into, there's one person on the ground who's calling the shots and then there's someone in the mech, it's like suddenly that's much more dynamic and set. It's just a way to set yourself up for success, or that we were able to set ourselves up for success, that I think worked really well in the context of this comic in particular.
Oh, for sure.
So you mentioned some of these dialogue tweaks being the last thing before you send a script off. Let's talk a little bit about the next step after you do send the script off, because you have managed to work with some really good collaborators here. I was very impressed by the illustrations by Fernando Pinto and the colors by Megan Casey and Mayday Trippy. I butchered all of those. So, why don't you tell us a little bit about working with those three and how you found them and what their email addresses is and what their rates are. And, what's it like working with those guys?
Fernando's a dream to work with.
Yes.
He we talked about this in the pre-show. He has a webcomic called Gun Punch, which is just this weird action-y body horror type thing, where like a guy's fist turns into a gun. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, this is a guy who understands the vibe of what we're going for.
Yeah.
And has the technical chops to pull off what we're going for. Because I feel like in every script we write, there's a joke, that only really comic book writers and comic book artists would get, that I say sometimes, when I email an artist, I'm like, all right, I'm going to go ahead and send you the draft of horses, cars, and people making out. Cool.
In the middle of Times Square, of course.
It's just like all of our scripts have the most demanding, complicated things that you can make an artist do. And yet at the same time, like, Fernando stepped up to the challenge and immediately started knocking it out of the park. I very rarely have any kind of like, negative things to say about, you know, getting panels back. It's almost always like, yep, this is incredible. Maybe tweak this just to make it more consistent with everything else. So that's been a dream to work with. Coloring has been a little bit more complicated. The reason there are two colorists is because we were working with one closely, and then unfortunately they couldn't finish the project, so we had to find another to fill in the role, which Meg has done brilliantly. But yeah, I think they absolutely nailed it. We wanted a very like Scott Pilgrim-y tone,
mm-hmm.
which is
you've got that.
Yeah, which is how we found Mayday, is that they colored the first ever, like, I think it was a Free Comic Book Day comic instance of Scott Pilgrim in color, which was kind of a bit of serendipity that we enjoyed. And so they had, you know, that very like flat colored scheme and palette worked very well with Fernando's art. And then Megan was able to pick up and do just about the same thing, mimics the style really, really well. You can barely tell the difference between Mayday's pages and Meg's pages, which is great. I love that.
So, Dalton, you've already teased us with Ultraman Trigger. I'm assuming this sounds like a genre that you have perhaps a number of influence to draw upon. Could you tell us a little bit about maybe a few more of the ingredients that went into this project?
The core of my being is superhero comics, pop punk, and giant monster movies. So like anything from Godzilla to like Blink 182 and Scott Pilgrim, honestly, like all of it kind of feeds into this. because, you know, I'm all about, I like the kinetic action, I like good momentum and giant set pieces. So, like, I've been watching Godzilla movies since, I don't even know if there was a time I wasn't watching Godzilla movies, honestly. I don't remember that far back. And, you know, Ultraman is more of a new thing that I've been getting. But Toku has always been there. Giant men punching giant rubber monsters. And, like, mecha anime, like Gundam, have always been a blast. I just like the big, the ridiculous, and yet all of that kind of grounded with characters that that you fall in love with. I know it's, he's not exactly the most popular guy in 2022 now, but I was one of those guys that was heavily influenced by Joss Whedon stuff, with those ridiculous concepts grounded with characters that you could get behind. You know, I can't root for Whedon anymore, but I still love Buffy, you know?
Yeah. And a number of these resource, references, has reminded me of something. I need to put out there real quickly, a public service announcement. Recently, the folks, I think it's Funimation, you know, I better get this right, because I'm already going to get sued by this, but, I want to make sure. I treated myself, or so I thought I treated myself, to a Christmas gift of a brand new box set collector's edition of Robotech, the complete series by Funimation. And I'm here to declare that multi-hundred dollar box set a atrocity at the level of something in history like Pol Pot or Stalin or Hitler. And I'm not exaggerating. They hype this up as some sort of remastering. And you know what? Maybe in some bizarro purist technical sense of like, hey, I want every scratch and hair and imperfection in the grain of the original film cells. If that's your version of the definition of, you know, a true remastering, fine, you know, then this is your, you know, wet dream of a box set. But for the rest of us who want clear images and an escape into the art and the animation, it's a total fucking disaster. I'm going to try to get my money back. Screw those guys. Everybody out there who's listening, who agrees with me, I'll be first over the gate. I'll bring out the chainsaw. We need to right this wrong.
Yeah. Okay. Let me ask really quickly, since we're already on this tangent, what is this a more egregious crime than the like magenta haze over the original Star Wars movies now?
Oh goodness! Now see, I'm not familiar with this. Which version is this is happening in Star Wars?
So I think last time I saw it, it looked like maybe they had fixed it. I don't know, but like the original Star Wars, because George Lucas like insisted on fucking with it so much, it now looks terrible because it has this like weird magenta haze over it, and obviously there are like, you know, CGI abominations everywhere, but. I'm just wondering where you stand on it. Would you rather a film be remastered in a sense that like all the imperfections are brought to the forefront, or remastered in the sense that all the charm is just sucked out of it?
Now, I think it may be possible. What you might be referring to are the versions that came out on home video discs, I think maybe in 2018 or prior. And I think they've rectified this with the 4K UHD versions that are currently on Disney Plus. Have you looked at those?
I have, yes. I looked at I saw The Empire Strikes Back over Christmas, and I remember thinking, oh wow, this looks really nice.
Yeah, I think those are good examples, and you still obviously get the feel of, you know, this was shot on film. And of course, that's the vibe I want for, you know, films that were shot on film. And there's a lot of choices you can make, you know, either way in there. But yeah, I'm way off on a tangent here. But yeah, screw the Robotech box set.
Well, then you should go check out all of Mill Creek. They've been releasing Ultraman over here in the West. Their mm-hmm. mission statement is to release every single Ultraman series since 1966 over here, and they've been doing a bang-up job so far.
Okay, so okay, cool.
Go support well, those remasters.
That's good. That's good. So you guys have teased something in my next area of curiosity, but I want you to expand on it a little bit. You guys went to college in a discipline that was either were you in a creative writing program?
Yes.
Okay. So
I was a minor of creative writing. My major was English, but and I think we Dalton, both were you chose, majoring in
yeah
on creative writing?
We both chose poorly.
I mean, true. Yeah. Regardless, we're splitting hairs, but like we, at the end of the day, we chose bad. Like we yes. chose things with no practical use.
So I'm gonna be greedy here, and normally I only have one guest, and normally I only ask one of these questions, but I've already got two of you, and I'm going to ask two examples, if possible, from both of you. Could you recommend to us or just pass along a lesson you've learned in writing that came from a some sort of a process book or process discussion or seminar or talk or DVD extra or whatever that really has resonated with you. And if you could divide it up, give me two examples, one that came from your academic career and one that happened afterwards. Wells, why don't you go first?
My temptation to just like regurgitate all of Bob May's class.
Oh no.
Be like Pasto and the six key elements. And...
Oh no, stop it.
Oh God. No, I think I'll do one and then I'll let Dalton go and I'll think about a second one. But I think my thing that I learned just from, not necessarily from an academic point of view, just from watching and observing like creative writing workshops and seeing people interact about writing was if you aren't willing to accept criticism, you're going to get nowhere. And not even like, you know, you can say, oh, okay, that's dumb. I don't think that's actually what it is. Like there's still room for that, but all the people who like whatever they made was perfect in their mind and you couldn't tell them otherwise, they like they never got anywhere, they never got any better. And I feel like that's like an incredibly underrated skill, is the ability to hear someone out and go, okay, even if I don't agree with the specific thing that they're saying is wrong, they're saying something is wrong and I should take that seriously. Yeah. I think that's like one of the most valuable skills a writer can have.
Oh, for sure. One thing that really stuck with me, especially from college and the writing courses, we had a fantastic professor, Gary Craig Powell. That man was...
GCP!
GCP was an inspiration. That dude wrote a short story. What was it? It was just called Sentence?
Sentence. And yeah, it's called Sentence.
It was how many pages?
It was like seven pages.
Seven
long.
Straight pages, and it was one whole sentence, and it didn't feel like a run-on. Like,
and it didn't have a semicolon.
No.
It didn't even have a fucking semicolon.
No, that dude's a master of craft, which brings me to, like, the point that you can follow all of the rules, and you can do all the thematic things, and you can do the seven whatevers that Bob May used to teach over and over. But if you don't have a voice, it's not going to really do, like craft over rules in a sense. Like just find something that works for you and just do it. And maybe the rules usually fall into place, you know, like character themes, you know, falling, rising action, those things tend to fall into place if you're writing from a place of confidence and a place of having your own voice there. And it never really matters what's technically on the page. As long as what's on the page reads well, then there are no rules. And that was a valuable lesson.
Yeah. Piggybacking off of that, I'll say maybe I'm wrong. I think I learned this in class. I think it was a Vanderslice class. If you're sitting there working out your story and you're thinking, oh, and this is where the rise, or more accurately, because that's a really garbage model for like story structure anyway. But if you're like sitting there thinking, this is the threshold and this is, you know, where you're, I don't know, there's so many different names for it. This is where you're entering the cave. If you're mapping out your story like that as you're writing it, it's probably going to feel really robotic and garbage. And the best thing to do is write a story. The reason that we have this kind of structure is because naturally that's just how we tell stories. And the structure kind of came afterward to explain it. But if you write a story and you're stuck somewhere, and then you think back on like, okay, well, what does the structure of a story look like? Very often that will solve your problem of like, okay, well, what happens next?
Yeah. The rules are very helpful tools, but they should not dictate what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
They're a guide, not a...
Right.
In the words of Captain Barbossa, they're more like guidelines, really.
Yeah.
And Dalton, do you have a second one, or do you want to conclude there?
A post-education thing I've learned. You know, I don't think I had one and now it's gone. So we can just move on.
Do what's fun for you and you know what? I'll jump in and say this. If you keep trying to write like people that you respect, you'll never figure out how you write. Like I used to get really depressed because I would be like, oh, wow, this, you know, Coffin Brown or Watchmen or whatever. This is brilliant. And this is so like intricate and deep and like the way the, you know, characters talk is so unique. I could never do that. And then I realized, why would I want to?
Yeah.
That's not the way I write.
Well, guys, it's been an absolute delight to have you on the program today. And I want to conclude by just asking you guys, where can we find the new campaign? How do we get there?
You can find it on Kickstarter because that's where it's being hosted. If you are having trouble finding it on Kickstarter, it is, as it's called, Mechaton, MECHATON. But you can also find us on Twitter, and we will be blasting about it every single day. I'm at Wells Thomp, THOMP. He's at Dalton K. Shannon. And you can also find, if for example, you're reading or you're listening to this super in the future and there's not a campaign going on, we have a Gumroad store. Gumroad, I believe the profile is Wells SRT, WELLSSRT. And that's where we put all the comics once they come out, so anyone can jump on at any point.
And for the current campaign, do you want to elaborate any on any particular reward levels or quirks or perks of this version of the campaign?
There is a variant cover that was drawn by Fred C. Stressing, who does Invader Zim. He does Rick and Morty. He does a lot of cool stuff over at Oni Press. That is an homage to Green Lantern 76, if you're familiar with that cover. Yeah, it's really cool. And that's the only place you're really going to be able to find it, unless you happen to find us at a con and we happen to have some extras laying around.
Trading cards.
There's some trading cards on this one. That'll probably wind up coming out on the Gumroad as well. There's also every, Kickstarter we do has a soup tier. So I give up some of my family recipes so that you, just to give you a little bit of a taste of what my home life growing up was. So we have a lovely lentil soup recipe. If you want to spend a little bit of extra cash to support the campaign and get something delicious out of it, I actually literally made it tonight. It is fantastic.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming on to the program, and I wish you the best of luck on the campaign.
Well, hey, thank you so much. It was a blast. Yeah, we're
really happy to be here.
They killed Milton!
Milton was still with us?
Where did you think he was?
I don't know. I thought he stayed back with the bus.
He was a really nice guy, and he sacrificed himself to help us. And now look at him. He's dead.
Oh, that guy, Milton.
So when did this great love affair with Milton start?
I liked him from the beginning, okay? I just didn't say anything